Good morning. For Friday, May 9th, it's The Conversation on HPR2. So you want to put your money where your mouth is? There's a new pack in town, and it's all about food. Ashley Lukens of the Hawaii Center for Food Safety has the details. Suzanne Fraser of Beach wants you to know there's no such thing as a biodegradable plastic bag. We'll talk about the Honolulu City Council Bill 38 and whether Hawaii should follow California's example to stamp out the word biodegradable.
And a Paniolo in the days of the overthrow provides the legend of Ko'olau. We'll get insight on this new work from playwright Gary Kubota. Later in the hour, Harvey Newquist, director of the National Guitar Museum, tells us why this instrument continues to have such a hold over guitar heroes of all ages. I'm Chris Vandercook.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. The conversation starts now. First, a look at this news. Good morning and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning, Beth Ann. How are you?
We've got lots of conversation that takes us back into the past and off into the future almost at the same time.
Exactly. The question of how to get action in the political arena. Yeah?
Well, that's going to be our first conversation. Let's get going. Now, depending on how you view them, PACs can be a band of enemies or fighters for social justice. As we've talked about many times on this program, PACs and super PACs look like they're here to stay. Now one has formed in Hawaii to fight political fire with food. And it's all about letting contributors put their money where their mouths are. Ashley Lukens is the Hawaii Program Director for the Center for Food Safety. And she joins us this morning. Hi there.
Aloha. Good morning.
When we talk about the new PAC forming, we should say it's yours. It's the Center for Food Safety's.
It's the Hawaii Center for Food Safety Action Fund. So yes, we are a PAC.
And this is a brand new thing for Hawaii.
Yeah, I think this is the ever food-focused PAC in the state.
What makes it time now for us to have a food PAC?
I think people are really looking for the opportunity to participate in the political process in a meaningful way. And I think this PAC provides them with that opportunity.
That seems to suggest that perhaps the way in which we've seen other organizations try to operate hasn't been as effective as a PAC might be.
Yeah, I think the food movement has been fighting with their shovels, fighting with their spatulas. We're in our kitchens, we're in our gardens, but we're recognizing how important the policy process is. And every policy sort of initiative needs to have an electoral component. And this is our opportunity to participate in the electoral process.
So how has this been received by others in the food policy movement in Hawaii?
I think people are really excited. I think they like the idea that this is going to be really well organized. We're going to be very targeted in how we participate in the electoral process. We have a lot of really great minds that are helping us come up with our plan. And it's going to help us harness just the incredible energy of the local food movement here in Hawaii, again, in really effective and targeted ways.
What do those effective and targeted ways look like?
I mean, reaching out to really strategic voter groups, understanding what elections matter, what elections we need to participate in, educating people, not just on our issues, but where candidates stand in terms of those issues.
That sounds like more than just the great public education efforts that we hear about so much or that we see happening, which are all very good and fine, but you're talking about a way in which you can see it show up in political results.
Yeah, I think it's been a shift for my thinking as well. I mean, understanding that, for example, a state house district can sometimes be won or lost on 1,000 votes, even 50 votes, 100 votes. So if we can really reach voters, give them a sense of where their candidates stand on certain issues, and give them the information they need to go out and vote, we're really going to have a powerful impact in the long run. And I think that's what the food movement is looking for. We have a lot of energy. We have a lot of support. This PAC just provides them with an opportunity to participate in a really meaningful way in a sort of abstract electoral process.
Do lawmakers really, even now, know enough for you to be able to represent their perspectives accurately to their constituents?
I think that we are going to go through a very formal endorsement process and let candidates tell us where they stand on our issues, and we'll just pass that information along to potential voters. And in the meantime, I think it will give candidates an opportunity to realize that food matters. People care about local, sustainable agriculture, and they want to see more advocacy at the state level.
And they haven't kind of gotten that already with all of the conversations we've had over even just GMOs, let alone anything else regarding organic, non-organic, but just that issue alone?
I think that we haven't seen an organized presence of the food movement in the electoral process yet. And so although I think they understand that these are issues that are important to the people, they don't realize how organized we are becoming and will be during this next legislative session. And this is just a part of educating voters and potentially advocates for that process.
Some have said, you know, there are a lot of people, but there are very few legislators. Shouldn't the weight be more centered on the people who have to be the ones who are the recipients of all these policies? And yet it always seems to shift the other way. What do you see as being the place where you can change that fulcrum so it's a little bit more heavier weighted toward a lot of what you're hearing from your constituency?
I think, again, it's a long-term plan. I think the food movement has been incredible at starting to participate in a political process that they were otherwise a little unfamiliar with. And as we become more educated and involved and organized, we're realizing that getting involved in elections is a necessary complement to the policy work that we want to do at the legislature. And by supporting the candidates that are our advocates, we empower them to further advocate for us during the legislative session. So this is just a part of a full year plan that I think the food movement really has to be better advocates during the session.
Meanwhile, while this year is happening, we've got an election coming up in November. How active do you see yourself in the coming election?
I think we're going to be really active. I mean, in Hawaii, you know, it's all about the primary. And so I think this summer is going to be an opportunity to take, you know, the thousands upon thousands of people that are really active on these issues in their everyday life, and again, give them a really well-organized opportunity to participate in the electoral process. And I don't just mean financially. I also mean contributing their time, their energy, their ideas, reaching out to neighbors and friends, particularly in those key districts where we think the election will be significant.
A lot of kitchen conversation.
A lot of kitchen conversations, a lot of phone conversations, a lot of canvassing, going door to door.
But still, this doesn't leave you a great deal of time, because here we are May 9th, in 3 months, we've got a primary.
Yeah, and not even, we haven't even had all the candidates pull their papers yet, so we don't even know who's running. But we've been thinking about it, we've been talking about it. I mean, the movement is geared up. On Maui, they are running a massive voter registration drive. And you're talking about a state where, you know, sometimes less than 40% of the population is voting in a primary election on an off year. So if we can register folks to vote and turn them out on Election Day, August 9th, even if we just turn out 500 people, that can have a really significant impact on an election. So I think although our movement's task is huge, I think this summer we have a manageable task that I feel really confident we can be successful with.
All right. Well, we're going to be watching you and having more conversations with you and others as it evolves. Thanks very much for coming in.
Thank you.
Ashley Lukens is the newly installed Hawaii Program Director for the Center for Food Safety. It's a follow-up to her recently minted PhD in political science from UH Manoa and her ongoing advisory work with the Hawaii Food Policy Council.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported HPR2. It's 8:13. Later in the show, legend and history combine in a Honolulu Theater premiere. But first, your backyard quiz.
Sandy Beach Park, often referred to simply as Sandy's, is a beach on Oahu's south side. It's well known for a powerful shore break, which makes for excellent bodyboarding and body surfing conditions. The beach is located between Hanama Bay on the west and Makapu'u Beach on the east, and is almost impossible to miss while you're traveling along the coast from Hawaiʻikai to Waimanalo. With such powerful waves breaking right onto the shoreline and occasional riptides, though, Sandy's can be a dangerous place for weaker swimmers, so beachgoers should always remember that tried-and-true saying, if in doubt, don't go out. Oahu isn't the only island where you can find a popular swimming beach bearing the name Sandy. And for today's quiz, yes, that's right, we're asking you to tell us the other island also having a sandy beach. Call us with the answer at 941-3689 or 877-941-3689, and we'll see who gets it right later in the show.
Aloha, I'm Gwen Woltz from Wahine Media, and you're tuned to HPR2, Hawaii Public Radio. Learn more about what you hear on the show at facebook.com/HIConversation.
Fiction can do much to bring history alive, taking us into the emotional core of a story. The emotions that roiled through the kingdom in 1893, the year of the overthrow, are the stuff of powerful drama for playwright Gary Kubota, whose new work takes us back to that time and into the life of a legendary Paniolo. The Legend of Ko'olau is about a man's struggles to keep his family together and survive, and Gary is with us this morning. Good morning, Gary.
Good morning. Thanks for having me here, Chris.
And I guess fiction isn't entirely an accurate way to describe this, because you've added dialogue or monologue, but to a true story, a well-researched true story, yeah?
Yes, it's. I did primary research at the State Archives, went through the books of the great Mahele, went through about 2 years of Pacific Commercial Advertiser and magazines, and had translations from Hawaiian into English done, basically to construct the events that occurred in as close to factual.
Let's summarize those events, Gary.
1892, Ko'olau and his family, his son and his wife, went into Kalalau Valley. He and his son contracted leprosy. 1893, there was this overthrow of the Hawaiian monarchy around January 17th. And things began to tighten in terms of the enforcement of leprosy laws. There was a deputy named Louis Stotes who went into the valley to try and get Ko'olau and force him to go to Kalapapa. Mm-hmm. And the Hawaiians at that time called it the living grave. And so Ko'olau had warned Stotes not to come in, or he'd kill him.
Mm-hmm.
And Stotes came in, and Ko'olau killed him. And Stotes was related to a missionary family. His wife was from missionary stock. And the missionaries had played a part in terms of the overthrow of the Hawaiian monarchy. So mm-hmm. they sent an army, more than 30 soldiers, a Krupp cannon, and then you had more than 20 deputies trying to capture Ko'olau.
After one guy and his family, he presumably has got a rifle and not much more, right?
Right. But he was a crack shot. He had been a foreman of Hawaiian cowboys mm-hmm. at about two ranches. And he also knew the terrain very well. And, all of this is part and parcel of being a Hawaiian in Hawaiian culture and on land where he'd hunt.
It's kind of a classic American story. It's not America, but it's the kind of story that, it's a Western. It's a one man's defiance of of the government, you know, enforcement of unjust laws, all that.
And what makes it interesting, too, is it goes beyond just being Western in the sense that he was Native Hawaiian.
Mm-hmm.
And so he had one foot in the Western culture and another foot in the Hawaiian culture. And I think that as the play continues, one realizes that as he moves more toward the Hawaiian culture, he becomes stronger.
Mm-hmm. So he finds strength in that identity, even as his government, the kingdom's government, has just been overthrown. Yeah.
Yes, I think that Kalalau Valley is vast, as a vast wilderness,
mm-hmm.
and understanding the way the weather and the winds and the mist and rain flow throughout the valley, and where one can protect oneself and how to drown out the sounds of walking and talking,
mm-hmm.
played a part in his survival.
Sure, it's that classic story of the individual who is familiar with his home terrain at home in the wilderness versus the interloper. Yeah.
Yeah, it's also about someone who's reluctant to be in that position. He was clearly educated as a Christian, and his wife was clearly educated as a Christian. So I think that for the most part, they really probably weren't as comfortable doing what they did.
His nature to defy authority by any means.
No, I don't think so. And the thing is that Stoltz actually was related to Stoltz's wife was Reverend Rowell's daughter.
Mm-hmm.
And he had gone to Reverend Rowell's church and gone to the mission there. So it was a very, you know, he knew these people and they knew him.
So as with history, as opposed to fiction, things aren't as cut and dried as sometimes fiction would have us believe.
Yeah, and I think that one of the things that comes out is, you know, that people do ponder these things. I mean, it's not a bang-bang, shoot-em-up kind of a play.
Yeah, no, it doesn't sound like that at all. But it does sound as if it raises a great many historical issues and mm-hmm. touches on some historical truths.
And I had a lot of help from various people, of Verdeen Kong. A lot of different Hawaiians have vetted the play. Visitors and residents have laughed and cried throughout readings, and now we've gone to full performances. I mean, they've used words like excellent, awesome, powerful in their descriptions of the play. So
it's a one-person drama.
It's a one-person drama, and it
done with as a product of your research.
Yes, but it's a one. Person, it's about a Native Hawaiian, and it's acted by a Native Hawaiian.
Mm-hmm.
What a novel concept.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
And Moronai Kanikoa, Maui High School graduate, also has a University of Southern California master's in drama, is the actor, and he's been doing a tremendous job. There's the number of lines he has to memorize in order to act out the play, they're more than the number of words in Hamlet. And he does a great job. So that debunks the theory that you can't find a Native Hawaiian who's qualified to do a film or something like that.
Well, I'm not sure if that theory would find too much coverage these days anyway, but yeah. all the more reason to move ahead with a story like this. How long have you been working on it?
I started about 35 years ago. A friend of mine named Wes Osano wanted us to do a film script, and we tried and didn't work. Then about in the 1980s, I met William S. Merwin, the poet laureate,
sure.
And I was interviewing him, and I told him about the story, and he and his wife Paula were just fascinated by it. We were having coffee in Kahului on Maui, and I said, listen, go ahead and do it if you want to. You know, it deserves to be told. And then about 15 years ago, I saw in the bookstore there was a thing called Folding Cliffs, and he'd done basically an ode to Kolau.
Uh-huh.
But all of these have been told from mainly Piilani's point of view. And so my friend.
Whose point of view?
Piilani, excuse me, is Kolau's wife.
Uh-huh.
And it's the stories have been told from the wife's point of view, because she was the lone survivor.
Mm-hmm.
My friend came back about 4 years ago and said, let's try it again. And so I wrote a song. I want to make sure I got something out of it. I wrote a song, and then I wrote I started writing the script, and then I wrote a kind of like a monologue, and I looked down at it after 40 pages. I said, you know, this is a one-man play.
Yeah.
And so I went hunting for a turkey. Well, no, not a turkey. I went hunting for something, and I got something else.
Oh, that's usually how it works with the
Yeah,
with the
and
work
you know,
like
just
this.
Follow your muse and try to do best you can.
Well, I'm sure you did, Gary. And thanks very much for talking with us this morning.
Thank you.
Gary Kubota is the author of The Legend of Ko'olau, play that will be performed in its Honolulu premiere Friday, May 16th at the Hawaii Theater. Details are at hpr2.org.
For 3 long years, no one could find them in the wild Nepali land. But leprosy did not forget them. Took first the sun and then the man. When she hid his bones deep in the forest, Pi'ilani said, I'm going with you anywhere. You're the only one for me. No matter what people say, you're my sweetheart and my friend till the end.
What would it really take to upload Johnny Depp's brain? I'm Ira Flatow. Join me on Science Friday as our scientist film critics weigh in on Hollywood's new techno thriller Transcendence, plus how young blood rejuvenates old mice, and a look at the earthquakes shaking up Oklahoma, all on Science Friday from PRI.
This morning from 9 to 11, right after the conversation.
HPR's base of support continues to grow thanks to the enthusiastic response to our Plus One new member program. Thanks to Dave Wilson and your Plus One, Scott Allen, Regina Snyderhood and your Plus One, Francis Hogan, and to Tim Vanderveer and your Plus One, Eric Gill, for participating in the Plus One campaign. Visit hawaiipublicradio.org/plusone to find out more or call your membership team at 955-8821 during business hours.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Honua Kai Resort and Spa on Maui, offering suites with fully equipped kitchens, dedicated to providing all the comforts of home with resort services. HonuaKaiMaui.com.
Four more schools will not be joining the ranks of Hawaii's charters, and a fifth application may also be denied by Hawaii's Charter Schools Commission very soon. Members of the rejected applicants say it was an unfair process. Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair takes a look at it in today's Reality Check. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
So how unfair is this process? That word kept coming up over and over again. How really elaborate are those applications?
Well, this hearing was yesterday, and they are fairly elaborate, can be quite lengthy, the application process. And as you indicated at the top, yeah, four applicants for charter schools found out yesterday it isn't going to happen. They're in Waipahu, Kona, on the Big Island. Another one is in trouble. That one's North Shore Middle School. The only one that made the cut was the Kau Learning Academy, which would be established in Na'alehu. But the commissioners who made those decisions says, look, there's increased rigor that is necessary in this vetting process. We're talking about greater accountability and, frankly, educational quality. This is taxpayer money, after all. So they feel like they have to have sort of a high bar when deciding which schools will be accepted for charter status.
Yeah, that high bar and the sense that somehow there's going to be a lot more that a charter school is going to have to be responsible in doing seems to be a good thing. How are these charter schools able to perhaps come back again if this is an all down and done now?
Well, a couple of things the commissioners cited yesterday for the rejections was insufficient planning, a failure to integrate Hawaii's culture into the learning model for the school. So those are some of the things that they can go back and work on. But some of the folks that were pushing for these schools yesterday were in tears. It was very emotional. You know, there's 33 charter schools in Hawaii. That's 10,000 students almost, and half of them are on the Big Island. And I mentioned that Kau Learning Academy was accepted. Well, part of the reason is because it's serving a high-needs, impoverished area. About a third of that population there is Micronesian. So these are some of the things that the commissioners have to take into consideration deciding who should become a charter school.
But that emotional need and the emotional drive to fill it doesn't necessarily sync with having the right things to do it, which is what the commission seems to be saying. If they have another opportunity to go back and do additional planning and to really get into some of the nitty-gritty pieces that obviously the commission found wanting, they'll be able to do this again anytime soon, or do they have to wait a long time now to be able to do it?
You know, I don't know exactly what the waiting time is to come back. I can tell you that Aaliyah Wong, our education reporter, the way she described this is that it's really about the changing charter school landscape. There's tensions growing in how Hawaii should deal with alternative learning communities. It is growing in popularity. So that, I think, is what the story is really reflecting, is something that's evolving, both the desire for these schools and the criteria to evaluate them. This is something the state legislature, Jill Takuda, the education chair in the Senate, have been very directly involved in.
But to do that, as you say, with a pretty high bar to ensure quality, which is where a lot of charter schools have had problems over the last couple of years, that seems to be a decent strategy, as long as it's consistent.
Yes, and of course that was one of the complaints, is that the evaluation process, some said, well, it just wasn't fair, it was uneven. And I suppose they can go back and try again at another time. But they are concerned about the fairness of this whole evaluation process.
Okay, for the moment, we've got to leave it there, but we'll watch it as it continues to play out. Thanks so much. We'll talk to you Monday. Have a good weekend.
Thanks, Beth Ann. You too.
Chad Blair is the political reporter for CivilBeat.com. Now from the BBC News to some news of Hawaii coming at us next week. Bill Dorman, Hawaii Public Radio's news director, joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann. You know, a lot has been said and continues to be said about homelessness, both here in Oahu and around the state. But there is something next week we're going to be taking a look at that may help on a very small scale right now. Still
quite
experimental.
Literally.
Yes, exactly. Talking about micro housing, you know, and as you know, these are very small units of about 200 square feet piece. It's about half the size of a two-car garage, actually. And designed primarily for individuals and individuals targeting the folks who are currently homeless but not wanting or not being able to be in a shelter situation. The idea is to put some of these together in a way that they are desirable as housing units and that they have a sense of community, actually. And there are a number of groups that are working on this. Proposal from the Hawaii Interagency Council on Homelessness to build some of these and actually just sort of see how this goes. Now, the Hawaii Community Development Authority has a piece of property that may be available for this, and we're going to take a look at what all would be involved. Wayne Yoshioka has been working on this for a little while. He's spoken with some architects, with the governor's homeless coordinator, Colin Kippen, and some other advocates, and we'll be getting a sense of how that might work and sort of what the next steps of that might be.
It almost sounds like a college dorm, that size square footage.
Yeah, you know, and it's, again, looking at more creative ways, perhaps, out of the box thinking in terms of approaching some of these issues of homelessness that we continue to wrestle with.
But opening very soon is going to be another healthcare facility that we've been waiting for a little while.
Yeah, boy, you know, this is a week from this coming Tuesday, the opening of the Queens Medical Center in West Oahu. And as you know, it's been about a year and a half now since Queens took over the Hawaii Medical Center West from the St. Francis Healthcare System. Longer than that, since that facility closed. There were a lot of renovations that had to go into this, a lot of reconstruction. Originally, Queens had wanted to open it this past February, but now they're set to open on May 20th. And before that, this coming week, we're going to get a bit of a preview in terms of what they have. They're going to have 80 beds to open, plan to increase that up to 135. But really, that's going to make such a difference in terms of acute care, particularly in that part of the community.
Now, we've talked a lot about news items, but that leaves out a little bit of arts and culture. Tell me you've got something coming good for us for next week.
Well, arts and culture are always a part of news as well, and I think most people in our listening audience of Hawaii Public Radio would agree art and education sort of go nicely together, and that's exactly the idea behind
it. But it doesn't always happen.
Well, on good days, and a set of exhibits now at Spalding House in Makiki here in Honolulu, what used to be the Contemporary Museum. Inquiring Minds, the Science Behind Art, and that goes through a whole series of exhibits, everything from the chemistry of ceramic glaze to some other little points behind the scenes of art that involve science, and it's sort of a unique way of thinking, really, that's interesting. It's an exhibit that lasts through July. Noe Tainagawa is going to have a bit more on that this week.
Sounds like a good one to take your kids to.
Yeah, exactly. Very family friendly. Yeah.
Well, good. We'll look forward to all of that next week. Meanwhile, have a good weekend.
And you too.
Bill Dorman is Hawaii Public Radio's news director. In 2008, the California legislature banned the use of the terms biodegradable, degradable, and decompostable on plastic bags, food, and drink containers. The law went into effect almost 18 months ago. Hawaii advocate Suzanne Fraser says there are some lessons for Hawaii about the greenwashing, in particular of the plastic bags, and that may come out in the proposed Honolulu City Council bill to ban plastic bags bearing the name biodegradable. Suzanne Fraser is the co-founder of Beach Environmental Awareness Campaign Hawaii, often just talked about as the acronym BEACH. She's in our studio this morning with a lot of bags. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
Good to talk to you again. Okay, so you've got a plastic bag sitting right there that is, it says biodegradable on it, and it has some other insignias on it, and including the manufacturer, who's under fire, and you're saying that with all the polyethylene in this thing, this is not at all biodegradable. It may break down, but it's not going to actually be able to not be harmful.
Yes, this is really a plastic bag in disguise. It does
say a plastic bag.
Yeah, it's really a plastic bag. It actually even has the symbol for plastic on here. It says HDPE, which is a number 2 plastic, and some bags are made with a number 4 plastic. But just writing the word biodegradable on it and putting a small bit of an additive in there, possibly 1% of this bag is starch, but that doesn't make the whole bag biodegradable. Only that 1% is biodegradable. The rest is plastic. And plastic does not biodegrade. It does not go away. It does photodegrade into smaller and smaller pieces. And by putting an additive in this bag, it actually causes the bag to look like it's breaking into it's breaking down, but it's all that it's really doing is breaking into pieces.
And your point is that, you know, smaller and smaller doesn't mean going away and not doing harm to animals, to plant life.
That's right. Actually, this is even more of a problem, because what volunteer would rather pick up 1,000 pieces of a bag than just one bag? And we've actually had one of these bags break into over 1,000 pieces at our house. And it said biodegradable on it, and it had number 4 plastic on it, and it just made a big mess. So imagine trying to clean up all the tiny pieces of plastic bags out of the sand, out of the water, out of the soil. It's really a disaster.
And many of those pieces are going to wind up in the stomachs of sea turtles and other marine life. But aside
yes, that's
from
a big problem, actually, yeah, because sea turtles can't eat a whole bag. They can only eat pieces of a bag. So this is even more harmful to sea turtles by causing bags to break into smaller pieces faster. And then with the food chain, If you've got teeny tiny pieces of plastic getting ingested by plankton, that's passing chemicals through the food chain that bioaccumulate all the way up to humans.
Right, that's sort of the point of it, that this thing never really does go away. It's just going to simply be absorbed by other animals that will eat other animals and wind up with us. But the issue that we could have a bag that says something that leads a lot of people to believe that they're doing something good for the environment, that they are being green, that they are being involved with their communities, seems to be
Really unfortunate that unscrupulous manufacturers of bags and additives are cashing in on that green movement and people's good intentions to want to do what's green and environmentally friendly. So they're printing these words biodegradable on bags and also on utensils and other things when they're really just plastic. And California went the whole way and banned those words, as you said, on all plastic items so that there was no more misleading going on.
That made it very simple, but there have been attempts to do that in Hawaii which haven't gone anywhere.
We have been down to the state and the city and discussed this whole issue to see if they did want to go the whole way. But we are so grateful that all of the efforts that we've put out have been heard by Honolulu City Council. Breen Harimoto has now introduced Bill 38, and that will ban biodegradable plastic bags so that we'll get a real plastic bag ban, just like Maui County's and Hawaii County's bans.
Because the one that was supposed to go into effect in about 6 months or so was that it was exempting bags that had the biodegradable stamp on it.
That's right. I mean, people were just going to replace the regular plastic bags with other plastic bags that had the word biodegradable on it. And, you know, Kauai actually had that in their law, and their Department of Public Works found that there were no bags and no manufacturers of bags that met their requirements for a bag to be considered biodegradable. So even though it was in the Kauai law, they couldn't put it into action because there's nothing out there. There's no magic solution to plastic. You can't just put an additive in it and it's going to magically go away.
Does this mean that there wasn't enough, perhaps, due diligence done around the word biodegradable as the initial plastic bag ban was crafted?
You know, unfortunately, our organization found out about this law about the day after it passed, so we didn't get a chance to go down there and testify and bring awareness to this issue. But our organization has been very involved in researching this for many years. We've been concerned. We've been talking to people who've been using the bags, like farmers at farmers markets, etc., to raise awareness of the fact that these really are plastic bags. So if we'd had that chance, we certainly would have raised this awareness. But I think this indicates how well the companies have been able to convince people. And the Federal Trade Commission is actually, just since October last year, they're cracking down on misleading and unsubstantiated environmental claims, and they're taking actions for the first time challenging these deceptive biodegradable plastics claims. And they've actually taken ECM Biofilms that's making the additive that's going in these plastic bags, actually the bag I've got here today that are being manufactured here in Hawaii. These, you know, what they're violating are the things including giving their customers and independent distributors the means to deceive consumers, you know, and they're also violating the FTC Act by misrepresenting that these plastics are biodegradable, and several other charges, including misrepresenting that various scientific tests prove their ECM biodegradability claims. So, you know, this company has gone all out in giving people the means to deceive their customers, and people have believed that information.
Next time that the bill is going to be heard is going to be a little bit later this month?
Yes, it's going to be heard again. It's passed the first reading this
last
week,
Wednesday.
And it will go into the committee hearing on Wednesday, the 21st of May at 1 p.m., and we encourage everyone to please send in testimony in support of that bill.
Meanwhile, if you have a bag that's not a plastic bag, like some of those others that are sitting there on the desk, those can be used, they can be washed. And as far as the claims that maybe they're breeding grounds for bacteria?
Well, look, there's so many alternatives. You can bring a basket. You can use the many boxes that are available. Costco has never provided bags. Everybody used boxes there. You can hand carry. Like you said, you can wash your bags. So we can all do the environmentally friendly thing and bring our own bags or use boxes.
But as far as that University of Arizona study from 2 years ago that said that there are possible breeding grounds for bacteria, that was also funded by the American Chemical Council.
Yeah, so I'm not familiar with that study, but, you know, it's a battle, you know, trying to go up against the plastics industry and the chemical industry.
But it looks like at least for the in the very short term, you may be winning the small one of the biodegradable plastic bag.
We hope so, for the sake of the environment, endangered and threatened sea turtles, and the food chain.
Thanks for coming in. We'll be watching this as it travels through its own journey over the next couple of weeks. And perhaps we're all going to have to get a lot more used to bringing our own bags with us if we're not doing it already.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for coming in. Suzanne Fraser is the co-founder of Beach Environmental Awareness Campaign Hawaii, known by the acronym BEACH. The all-volunteer nonprofit focuses on solutions to plastic marine debris through environmental education and plastic reduction.
Good morning, I'm Jerry Silva from AARP Hawaii. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR2. Find out more about the show at hpr2.org.
Earlier this morning in our backyard quiz, we took a trip to Sandy Beach, a.k.a. Sandy's, on Oahu's south shore. The beach park is between Hanama Bay on the west and Makapu on the east. It's hard to miss along Oahu's Kalaniana Ole Highway from Hawaii Kai to Waimanalo. The beach is best known for its powerful shore break, which makes for body surfing and excellent body surfing conditions. But Oahu isn't the only island we could find a popular beach called Sandy's. For today's quiz, we asked you to name it. This sandy beach is located on the east side of its island and is considered one of the better swimming beaches. The clear waters and a steep drop-off of the near-shore ocean bottom make it easier to enter the water without having to walk on the reef, and the next time you find yourself on Molokai, you might want to check it out. At 8:48, that's the answer to today's quiz. And if you have a backyard quiz for us, you can send it to talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for The Conversation comes from Bush Consulting, providing IT support, customized network services, and backup recovery for Hawaii's businesses since 1990. Learn more about outsourced IT at buschconsulting.com.
The guitar has a special place in the history of Hawaii, and Hawaii has a special place in the history of guitar. People here have loved the instrument ever since the Paniolos and local cowboys gathered around the campfires and created kihualo. Guitar in all its incarnations continues to inspire Hawaii's musicians, so this is a good time for a traveling exhibit called The Guitar, the Instrument That Rocked the World, to come to town at the Bishop Museum. Harvey Newquist, director of the National Guitar Museum, came to town along with it, and he joins us this morning. Good morning, Harvey.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Good to have you. You were reminding me of how important Hawaii was in the whole expansion of the country at large, love of the guitar.
Yeah, that's true. A lot of people think that rock and roll or even blues drove the creation of the electric guitar, but really it was the widespread infatuation that mainlanders had with Hawaiian music that prompted the creation of the electric guitar, because there were so many bands playing Hawaiian music, and so as they played bigger venues and bigger halls, the guitar players who were playing lap steel got drowned out. And so George Beauchamp, a guy who was the leader of a Hawaiian band, decided, I need to be louder. So he electrified the guitar, and while playing Hawaiian music, invented the first mass-produced electric guitar. So there's a real direct correlation between Hawaiian music and the creation of the first electric guitar.
And it's hard for people to realize just how prevalent Hawaiian music was as American popular music, what a widespread influence it had, yeah.
Well, starting in 1915, the Pan-Pacific or Pan-American Pacific Convention in San Francisco had a Hawaiian pavilion. And from that moment till the beginning of World War II, Hawaiian music was the most popular form of music, bar any other form, in mainland America. And so you had bands, you had sheet music, you had some of the earliest vinyl discs, all being driven by Hawaiian music, much more than jazz or country or any other form. So Hawaiian music really helped drive not only the music business, but the guitar itself.
In living rooms in New England, you'd see sheet music on the piano with islands and little palm trees.
You would. They'd all be etched into the bodies of the guitar. And it was so pervasive that by the time the electric guitar became popularized, companies that were making the guitar actually had to call them ES for electric Spanish, so that people wouldn't lay them down on their laps expecting to play them in Hawaiian style. So it was really something that was so pervasive that, you know, people had to be taught that there were other ways to use the guitar, because Hawaiian music was just kind of the default way to play the electric guitar.
There are all kinds of references in various histories of the blues, which you think of as a very isolated rural, you know, Arkansas,
exactly,
Mississippi style, that are where they're constantly referring to their guitars and to their style of playing as Hawaiian.
Right. And a lot of the music, slide music, detuned music or slack key music, was directly influenced by Hawaiian music and had a huge influence on early blues players who would tip their guitars up to face outward but still play them with slides just as they would Hawaiian music.
Well, I'm sure you see this, you know, as somebody who is able to take a real overview of the world of guitar. This has got to be one of the most adapted and adaptable instruments ever created, yeah?
Well, it really is. And one of the reasons for creating the exhibit and bringing it here to the Bishop is to show people just how pervasive the guitar has been in world culture. I mean, every year, just in America alone, 3 million new guitars are sold. And that number outstrips every other instrument sale combined. So you can add tubas and pianos and drums and clarinets and saxophones together. They don't even come close to the number of guitars that are sold just in America alone. So not only are guitars sold in huge numbers, but we all have an affinity for the music that the guitar has created. For the last 50 years, it's been the most important instrument in the creation of popular music.
And there really is no limit on the direction, the musical direction you can take. I mean, are you seeing it go in all new directions every day?
Yeah, you do. I mean, if you think about it, you know, having evolved, at least in America, in the mid-40s and 50s, from Hawaiian style to blues to country and western to surf music to rock, you know, now you see people using it to play Indian ragas and Central African music. And it's just been incorporated into so many styles of music that its potential seems to be limitless.
I had an Indian guitarist, Rajneesh Bhattacharya, sit in the studio. His strings were about an inch off the neck, laid it in his lap. And I said, can you make that sound like a sitar? And he said, oh, sure. And then I said, can you make it sound like a sarod? Oh, yeah. And, you know, he could do any other Indian stringed instrument on the guitar, and it was dead on.
Well, and the guitar has taken so many shapes and forms, and that's one of the things that we do in the exhibit is show people that, you know, starting way back when with things like the oud and the tambour, which have been around for thousands of years, it evolved into a number of instruments, all of which are related in some way to the guitar, like the ukulele, the banjo, the mandolin. But somehow in modern times, we find that the guitar still seems to be the jumping off place for so many forms of music.
Well, I really look forward to seeing this exhibit, Harvey, and it's good to talk to you.
Oh, well, thanks very much. Come on down. We're at the Bishop till September 1st.
We'll send people your way.
That would be great.
Harvey Newquist is the director of the National Guitar Museum, and the exhibit, Guitar, the Instrument That Rocked the World, runs from May 10th to September 1st at the Bishop Museum, and you can find out more at hpr2.org.
Kavika Kahiapo and Keale kick off HPR's Atherton summer season on Saturday, May 10th. The duo, in their first appearance, will bring their beautiful vocal harmonies to traditional Hawaiian favorites and original mele. Kavika Kahiapo and Keale in HPR's Atherton studio, May 10th at 7:30 p.m. For tickets, call 955-8821 during business hours or go online at hprtickets.org.
Bethann Gary Kubota has written quite a challenging play about a real-life story, and this is a man who essentially defied the new government right after the overthrow that was trying to cart him and his son away to Kalaupapa. Pretty dramatic evocation of a very dramatic time. Little-known historical story.
And those are the kinds of stories that remind us that that kind of disobedience has been going on for a long time. It's not something that's in and of a modern generation.
And this is a man who's very much a product of missionary education. It was his inclination was to, you know, go along, do the right thing, and yet forced to essentially become a fugitive in his own home valley.
Well, it's going to be a good play, and I'm looking forward to seeing it.
Yeah, it sounds like pretty powerful stuff, doesn't it?
Really powerful, and you have to know when you're walking in to something like that. There are a couple of other stories we're going to be talking about next week that are equally as powerful, and they have to do with Afghanistan and The Hornet's Nest, which is a new film that's coming out, so stay tuned for that. And while we're talking about next week, we've got a lot of good things coming up, including what does it take to be a leader among the next generation of state workers, particularly millennials. We're going to talk with Omidyar Leadership Fellow Leila Kagawa, who's the Deputy Director at the State Department of Human Resources and Development.
And we'll meet the director of that documentary about Afghanistan, A View from the Front Lines.
It's going to be a really wonderful conversation. Wow, looking forward to that one. Meantime, you can let us in on your radio talkback. Find us on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation, on Twitter at HI Conversation, and our email is talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Lots of choices.
And you can always find the music playlist at hpr2.org. And also you can listen back to today's show. Our executive producer is Bethann Kozovich.
Lillian Song produces the program. Taylor Rice is our production assistant.
And the Backyard Quiz theme is written for us by John DeMello. I'm Chris Vandercook.
I'm Bethann Kozovich. We'll meet you on Monday back here for more of The Conversation. Have a good weekend.